Today we're tackling two of the wisdom books. We covered Job. Today we'll take a look at Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Something I need to say probably, and I may have said it before, and that is what I'm talking about ties in with the English 245 class that I offer at Palomar College. And so I'm not providing lengthy intros to each of the books that we go over because there's a small booklet that I have put together for my students, and they have that with them. And so if any of you are listening to these talks and you're wondering why I'm not spending a lot of time telling you when a book was done and who's the author and what was the situation, it's because it's already covered in a booklet. And if you'd like more information on that, just email me in care of the school, gzacharias@palomar.edu. And I'd be glad to get back to you and give you some more information. So we're looking at Proverbs. And again, another, warning or comment is that we'll be talking about Proverbs now as just going through the book quickly, four or five chapters, get a feel for it, just dip our toes in the water. But we're going to come back and look at Proverbs later as a literary tool and see what the genre of Proverbs looks like. So we'll come back. We'll touch that later as literature. Right now, we're trying to get a feel for what Proverbs is. It is a section of wisdom literature, and some people get very, very disappointed with it because they read it and they see things like this. I'm going to walk you through several verses first, and we'll come back and take a look at it in order, the chapters that I assign. But if you look in chapter 3, verse 2, it's talking about commandments that this person has been teaching his son. He says, "These commandments will prolong your life many years and bring you prosperity." Okay, then let's take a look at chapter 10. You're going to hear an echo of that in verse 3. This is a different one. "The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked." Okay, how about 10:27? "The fear of the Lord adds length to life, but the years of the wicked are cut short." Let's go next door, 11:31. "If the righteous receive their due on earth, how much more the ungodly and the sinner?" Then 13:25 says, "The righteous eat to their heart's content, but the stomach of the wicked goes hungry." One last one, I think you see the trend here, but let me pick one more here. How about chapter 22, verse 6? "Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it." So there are comments made here about the righteous. There are comments made about the wicked, learning these commands and how they'll protect people. And then a comment here about if you just train a kid the right way, then he or she, as they age, will not turn from it. So let me ask you, are these things always true? Have you encountered situations that were not neat and tidy, as this says, where the unrighteous actually seemed to do pretty well and the righteous ended up suffering? You can probably think of cases in your life where you did the right thing and instead of being rewarded for it, you're the one who got into trouble. You're the one that lost money. You're the one that got into an argument. You're the one that suffered somehow from society. So that's one thing I want you to think about. These proverbs do not give us absolute truth. These are not promises. What are they? Well, I think they're generalized statements about how life tends to go. All right, so this is the bell curve, I guess you might say. But unfortunately, with a bell curve, we know that there are edges of each of the bell curve that are not typical. And so I think something like that happens here in the book of Proverbs. So don't think about it as a promise and grab onto a verse and ride that thing the rest of your life. All right, so that's one thing to think about. Now, I assigned in particular to the class Proverbs chapters 1, 4, 10, and 31. Why these particular ones? Because they give us a flavor for what's going on here. So if we look at Proverbs 1 as an example, it says, verse 7 seems to be a key to the whole book. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline." So notice what it's talking about here. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And you might want to think about the word fear, but knowledge doesn't begin with trivia. It doesn't begin with stuffing our heads full of facts. Notice this is a religious book, and so, like all religious books, it has insights into God. And so the start of knowledge is not factual. It's understanding that there is a supernatural element to life. You might think about that word, the fear of the Lord. How do you picture that word, fear? Are we talking about absolute shaking and quaking and trembling and anxiety? I don't think so. I think there's a healthy kind of fear, and that's what we're talking about here. It strikes me today that a lot of songs that people sing and the way they approach God, it's almost like God is their best friend or God is a cosmic waiter who's going to come bring them things. But this says you need a little fear of the Lord. So chapter 1 talks about wisdom, the conflict of wisdom versus folly. And we find out a lot of the things that go wrong here, enticement, wrong things that cloud our thinking. And verse 20, chapter 1, wisdom calls aloud in the street. And then listen to the pronoun. She raises her voice in the public square. And at the head of the noisy streets, she cries out in the gateways of the city. She makes her speech. And so I would like you to think about that. Wisdom is personified as a woman. Now, isn't that interesting? Here's a book coming out of a culture that was very patriarchal. Think about how many rulers they had. They were men. Think about the prophets they had. They were men. Think about the judges they had. Well, there was a woman or two, right? You remember Deborah. But mostly they were men. So again and again, we get the story where men dominated this society, and yet in Proverbs, it's displayed as a woman raising her voice. So I'd like you to consider that for a minute. Why do you suppose a woman rather than a man? Don't the men get to run everything? I'll let you think about it. I've got some ideas, but I'll let you consider that. Okay, so personification of wisdom is a woman. So I had you look at chapter 1. I think that's an important one. Let's go to chapter 4. Look at verse 6. We're still on this wisdom thing. This time it's the father instructing his sons here. Do not forsake wisdom in verse 6 of chapter 4. She will protect you. Love her and she will watch over you. Wisdom is supreme. Now remember, wisdom is part of knowing your place in relationship to God. I'm not sure we've talked about wisdom. It strikes me that wisdom is very different than knowledge. I hope you agree. Wisdom is the right use of knowledge. We can have all sorts of knowledge. You know people like that. They have knowledge, but they don't use it particularly well. So wisdom is supreme. Verse 7, therefore get wisdom. Though it cost all you have, get understanding. So I think about our society today. Wisdom is not put on the top, is it? What would you put there as far as what our society says? Probably money, notoriety, being seen on television, having a great girlfriend / boyfriend, driving a powerful car. Those are the things that you want to fight for, a great job. And this says, no, wisdom is supreme. Verse 18, the path of the righteous is like the first gleam of dawn, shining ever brighter till the full light of day, but the way of the wicked is like deep darkness. They don't know what makes them stumble. So it looks like we have a choice here, don't we? And he's going to lay out the path of the righteous and suggest that it's far better than the way of the wicked. And it's up to us. So I don't see any lack of moral freedom here. We can't blame it on our parents. We can't blame it on bad education. If we don't get wisdom and understanding and lead a solid, useful life, that's our fault. Let's go to chapter 10. I wanted you to see just right here examples of Proverbs. And we'll come back, as I said, when we talk about this as a form of literature. But if you notice something like Proverbs 10:4, lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. Verse 5, he who gathers crops in summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. Verse 11, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. About 12, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. Did you notice Proverbs is a kind of an odd book to read because it's so full of information, it doesn't seem very organized. It's just raining down on us of various ideas for our lives. So it frustrates those who want to be going through something in a linear fashion where one thing adds to something else. Now the Proverbs are just sprinkled throughout this. Finally, I'd like you to look at Proverbs 31. And again, think about this patriarchal society that this comes out of. This is the epilogue near the end of chapter 31. And you probably have a note on this. It says verses 10 to 31 are an acrostic. Now, acrostic means every verse begins with the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So for us, we might say in our first verse, a day dawned like no other. So we started with the letter A, and then we go to the next verse, B. Beyond the sunset was a delightful cloud cover. Right? So you go B, and then you go C. Can anyone doubt that the day would be lovely? Right? So you go A, B, C, D, E. And so that's what they're going to do here. Every verse is the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So it goes basically from A to Z. So do you hear what's going on here? It strikes me that they're saying the wife of noble character, this is the best woman possible from A to Z. This covers everything. So I want you to notice this. A wife of noble character, verse 10. What does she do? Well, let's consider this society that's so patriarchal. Woman had a pretty piddling role in that society, but that's not the way the author of Proverbs sees it. Look what she does. Verse 13, she selects wool and flax and works it with eager hands. Okay, that's probably how we picture women in these societies, stuck at home doing all of the tough work at home. But says she's like the merchant ships. I'm just continuing on. Verse 14, bringing her food from afar. She gets up while it's still dark. Okay, so we know she's a hard worker. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. Okay, again, sounds fairly traditional. But what about verse 16? She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. Whoa, so here's a woman with some economic power, and she thinks about it and is very careful. She considers that field. This is not whimsical shopping or anything. This is careful consideration. Verse 17, she sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her task, so she's tough physically. 18, she sees that her trading is profitable, so she follows through. She's careful to follow these economics. Her lamp does not go out at night. Verse 20, she opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. So she extends her work outside of herself to her neighborhood, to those around her. Verse 21, when it snows, she has no fear for her household, so she's taking care of everybody there. Verse 23, her husband is respected at the city gate. Well, he's respected because she's got him together too, got his act together. Verse 24, she makes linen garments. She sells them, supplies the merchants with sashes. Verse 26, she's not just a hard worker, she speaks with wisdom. Verse 27, she doesn't eat the bread of idleness. Her children call her blessed, so she's raised her family well. And then a nice ending here, I would say, in verse 30. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Kind of interesting perspective, isn't it? We value beauty so much in our society. You look at all the good-looking people that are sprinkled across our magazine covers today. And I think we've got our priorities screwed up. There's some kind of an inner quality, an inner beauty that's going on here. Somebody who's got her mind the right way, and she's handling all these other things in life. How is that for a woman? This sounds like a feminist document to me. She can do it all. I am woman. Hear me roar. She's handling family. She's handling the economics of things. She considers. She buys. She sells. She takes care of the poor nearby. I get exhausted just reading about this. It's pretty impressive. By the way, there are 31 chapters here. Some people do a chapter a day and end up at the end of the month having gone through the entire book of Proverbs, and they'll do it again and again. So quite a powerful book. It's certainly influenced a lot of people. Whenever you read a self-help book, there's probably a little bit of Proverbs advice in there. So I hope you have a chance to read it in more depth. So we'll come back to that again, as I said. I wanted to end this section looking at one last wisdom book called Ecclesiastes. Wow, what a change. We've got this buoyant, can-do, positive thing, the good do well and the wicked are punished. And then we come to something like Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. The words of the teacher, leader of the assembly. And what does he say? Verse 2, meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Verse 3, what does man gain from all his labor, which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. And so we get this cyclical view of things. The earth goes on, the earth goes on. People come, people go. It's the earth that maintains. Nothing else does. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. Verse 9, there's nothing new under the sun. And so I'm just looking ahead here. It's not very encouraging. The subsection for the rest of chapter 1, wisdom is meaningless. Chapter 2 starts off, pleasures are meaningless. It continues, wisdom and folly are meaningless. Toil is meaningless. And I see verse chapter 4, oppression, toil, and friendlessness. Advancement is meaningless. Riches are meaningless in chapter 5. So a lot of people say, well, is this just totally a downer? What is this? But I want you to see that if you look more closely, it's an alternate negative and positive kind of thing here. Verse 1 of chapter 1 starts off with this meaningless, meaningless. If you go over to 2:23, okay, some people see that first section ending there about what does a man get for all his toil and striving. Verse 23 of chapter 2 says, all his days his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. And then, and I agree with this, there's a subtle break right there. Chapter 2, verse 24, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. Verse 26, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and happiness. So that seems a little more balanced, doesn't it? And that continues to chapter 3, the end of the chapter. Look at the end of the chapter 3 there. So I saw there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that's his lot. Who can bring him to see what will happen after him? And then the next section throws cold water back on us. Chapter 4, verse 1, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. And that continues about half of that chapter. Go down to 4, verse 9. Now we're back to the positive. It's kind of a ping-pong match. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. Right, so that's nice. But verse 13, better or poorer, etc., etc., advancement is meaningless. And so I want you to think about it, back and forth sections here, but a lot of negative things that people scratch their head and they say, this is in the Bible? What in the world? But it sounds very modern, doesn't it? A lot of people, modern authors in particular, were really taken with this book because it stares life in the face and says, under the sun, it's pointless. But you know, that's the key to this thing. Over and over, we get that phrase, under the sun, things are meaningless. Under the sun, things don't amount to anything. Under the sun, life is just a vapor or a wisp. But I think what he's getting across here is, under the sun, phrase means, if that's all you see of life, is just what's naturally in front of you. That's called naturalism. You just see things around you and you don't picture a supernatural world. It's just get up, go to a job, try to make some money, and he who has the most toys wins, and eventually you die. So under the sun, if your world is bounded by what you can see and touch and hear and taste, you're a naturalist. According to the Bible, you've missed out on another huge aspect of life. And in fact, at the end, notice what it says. The very last few verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Here's the conclusion, he says. Verse 13, fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So there are the goods, right? There's the conclusion of things. God's in charge, and he'll make it all okay. I want to hit a few things along the way. Oh, I mentioned that it was a popular book. I bet you even heard an echo, didn't you, at the beginning there where it says, the sun rises and the sun sets. The King James Version will sound a little more familiar. The sun also rises is verse 5 of chapter 1. Does that sound familiar? That was Ernest Hemingway. He took that for a novel. And you know, if you had known the Bible and you knew this verse well and you're ready for the book, you would have anticipated the kind of book it was. The sun also rises is about people who live the very life that this man is talking about here. Meaningless pleasures, the folly of life. Nothing makes any sense to these people. They've gone through World War I, and some of them are physically wounded, and others are spiritually wounded. Herman Melville liked this book a lot. I think of science fiction. Chapter 1, verse 4 says, the earth remains forever, or it says, earth abides. I think it's a King James Version. There's a really good science fiction novel called Earth Abides. So people have grabbed titles out of here, and it's been very powerful. I wanted to read something to you to have you thinking about Ecclesiastes compared to the, I'm not picking on her, but the Oprah Winfrey approach to life, which is, I guess we call it the New Age view, that we just have to think better, that there's no such thing as bad stuff in our lives, that we're just thinking wrong. And once we do that and determine that everything's okay, it will be okay. And I think that really flies in the face of what Ecclesiastes is saying here. And you can decide yourself whether you think there really is evil and meaningless things and hard toil in life. And that Ecclesiastes is a good book to actually make us face that. Or whether you agree with this person I'm going to read to you. He's an advisor to Oprah Winfrey. His name is Harvey Cohen. And here's the New Age approach, which strikes me as pretty naive. And feel free to email me. We can talk about this. But here's what he has to say. You're not here just to live and be separated from those you love by death. Death is BS. There is no death. Nothing in the universe dies. Only changes. You are not here to struggle, be in pain, or experience lack of limitation. You are here to experience the full realization of your cosmic nature. And your cosmic nature is to live your life out of your highest ideals and desires. Your cosmic nature is to have it all. That's why you're here. The universe always says yes to whatever ideas you believe. Believe that you will, and you will. Believe you are greater than your struggle. Boy, there's no message like that in Ecclesiastes, is there? It's a pretty tough book that says if all you're doing is trying to get through life, and trying to plow ahead there, you're in for a tough time. Something that, as I age, I find interesting is in chapter 12. And this is, let's start at chapter 12, verse 1. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach, when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. So, this is the look ahead. This man has found, as he wrote the book, he's found problems with toil, he's found problems with pleasure, he's found problems with jobs, and now problems with aging. And so let me read some of this and see if you can figure out what are the aspects of age that he's warning people about? Verse 3, when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. Now you may say that one's pretty obvious. Okay, let's keep going. When the grinders cease because they are few. Have an idea about the grinders? And those looking through the windows grow dim. When the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. When men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets. When the almond tree blossoms. Now, almond trees blossom, and they have a white shade to them. And the grasshopper drags himself along, and desire no longer is stirred. Then man goes to his eternal home, and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So I won't take the time now, but I think if you read that over, you'll find that, I hope you find that pretty powerful as far as just the different aspects of life start shutting down when age comes on the scene. People who are young, of course, think they're immortal. They'll live forever, but this is a good warning. You know, enjoy it while you got it because it's going to go on you. Well, that's a cheery way to end this section, isn't it? Sorry to end you on a downer like that. We'll pick up songs next time, far more cheerful. We'll look at the Book of Psalms, which is a collection of songs. And if we have some time, I think we will, we'll look at Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, it's called. So that's a love song, which is really cool to encounter that in the Bible, although we'll talk next time about how some people have been pretty uncomfortable with that book. So we're ending on a down one today, but next time it'll be a little more cheerful.